Good morning. Good to see you all. I'm impressed that you come out on a Sunday morning for this because it's extremely important conversation, but also not an easy conversation. So I'm impressed that you took the time to come out. Thank you for coming. So basically what we're doing, this is something we've done in the past. It's been a few years since we've done it, but it's important to do on a regular basis because it's so crucial. It's probably one of the most significant needs that we see in the hospital. And it has been for the last 40 years or so, which is that basically since we developed the capability of keeping people alive artificially, which is such an incredible blessing that we can keep people alive so much longer than we ever could in the past, there's like the flip side of the coin, which is that we're now able to keep people alive in ways that they are unable to communicate with us. And there's so much that medicine can do, which is such a blessing that medicine can do so much, but it means that there's lots of choices to be made. And how do you make choices for someone when they are now being kept alive in a way that they can't speak for themselves, and there's a lot of options? We're left with that, with a major dilemma. And so the solution that has been kind of the best solution for the past 30, 40 years has been these documents called advanced directives. And they are not perfect documents. There's no perfect solution because unless we had prophecy to be able to know what a person would want when they can't speak for themselves, and we don't have that, but it's the best that we've got. And so what we've been trying to do for the last number of years is to try to develop the best advanced directive to do the best job we can of knowing what someone would want if they couldn't speak for themselves. And I think we've come up with a document that is much improved, and I'm going to describe it. So there's different types of documents. One is known as simply a proxy. A proxy is a document that it's also known as durable power of attorney, which is where someone simply appoints others to speak for them. And that's a simple document, which is important to have because we don't always know who the person would want speaking for them. Sometimes we don't know enough about a person, or other times we just don't know who that person would want to speak for them. So that's one type. There's also what's known as a living will or advanced directive, which is much more detailed usually. And that's where a person puts a lot of detail about what they would want and what they wouldn't want. For many years, it was more focused on what a person would not want, which is why many rabbis were concerned about these documents, because they would give you lots of options of what you don't want, and sometimes those would contradict halachic options, and so there was some concern. What became very popular amongst many rabbis was to say, you know, just appoint your proxy and then write a document or write a small writer, like a short paragraph or something, just describing some of your basic values. Are there things that you would never want done to you? Are there things you would always want? You know, what are your basic goals? Are you the type of person that would say, I don't care how much pain is involved, do everything you can to prolong my life? Or are you the type of person that says the opposite? Of course I want to live, but I don't want to be in a permanent vegetative state on machines indefinitely. You might have values about that. You might say, at the end of the day, I want my rabbi to decide, but here's some basic values about you should know about me, and then let the rabbi decide. Or you might say, no, I only want my partner to decide, or my child, or a parent. There could be a lot of ramifications, permutations of that. And so the rabbis would say, just point your proxy and give us a little bit of detail. Because for rabbis, they'll get these calls. And, you know, hopefully all of us know our rabbis very well. Or whoever you point, you know, your spouse or child. But they might realize when they're asked these questions, gosh, I don't really know what they would want in this situation. We never talked about it. People are often afraid. You know, a lot of people in our community think that it's an ayin hara to have these conversations. It's like a bad omen. If you talk about it, it will happen, right? Just like if I say there's, you know, oh, it's so nice. I drove here this morning. I had to stop at the airport and drop someone off, but I made it on time. There was no traffic. And after I have to go to the airport again, it's great. There's no traffic. Well, now if I said that, oh, I jinxed it. There's going to be horrible traffic. That's ridiculous. But okay, I mean, I shouldn't say it's ridiculous. People believe that there's like this ayin hara. So, okay, that's a ridiculous example when I'm talking just about, you know, like going to the airport. But people worry that, you know, al tiftach pe lasatan. If I talk about these things, it might happen. It's like testing fate. On the other hand, there's a beautiful tradition that we have, which is that some of you might have heard of this. There's a belief that if you purchase your kever, you purchase your burial plot while you're young and healthy, it's what we call a segula for richas yamin. A person will live longer if they purchase their burial plot. Why would that be? So on the one hand, you could say, well, is that really true? Could we do a study and see people who have a burial plot, do they live longer? But I remember I once heard Rabbi Abraham Twersky of Blessed Memory explain that what it means is that if, what does arichas yamin mean? The literal translation of arichas yamin. Length of days, exactly. So what does length of days mean? There's a story about the Sfas Emes. The Sfas Emes was, you know, a great Hasidic rabbi who died in his 50s. And at the Shiva, someone said to his son, well, at least he had arichas yamin. So first of all, it's a weird thing to say at a Shiva. Usually you should never say at a Shiva, a phrase should never start with, well, at least. That's not usually a good way to start. Oh, at least they didn't this. But anyway, someone said to him, at least he had arichas yamin. So his son responded, what does that mean? He died in his 50s. That's not a long life. So he said, no, I didn't say arichas shanim. He had long years. He had arichas yamin. What I meant was he made the most of every day. He made the most of his life. He lived a short life, but he really accomplished a lot in his short life. And so Rabbi Twersky said, what it means to that purchasing one's burial plot while they're alive is that when we recognize the fragility of life, when we recognize the fact that we all are mortal, that we all will only live so long, it forces us to make the most of every day. And so the rabbis say, just like there's a value in purchasing one's burial plot while they're young, because it reminds them, like, I have to make the most of every day. I only have so many days on this planet. So too, planning ahead and thinking about what will happen if I'm, God forbid, sick one day. And in fact, there's a tradition amongst the rabbis that age 50 is the year that someone should have an advance directive. Now, one of my rabbis always said, you should always have an advance directive. He tells his people to have an advance directive from age 16. Because, you know, driver's license, there's a certain amount of risk you take upon in your life at age 16. So that's what he would say. Also, age 50 is not that old today anymore. Age 50 is pretty young, especially as I approach it, I recognize it's really young. But really, it's not that old. But still, the rabbis felt, you know, at Cedars-Sinai, when we created our new advanced directive, they told all the primary care physicians, tell all your people age 52. Why 52? Well, age 50, there's certain things like colonoscopy, there's certain things that the doctors recommend. So they thought, 50s, there's too many things. So give them a couple more years to do it. But there was a tradition amongst the rabbis at age 50. The Torah says, "V'kidashtem eshnasa chamishim." You should sanctify the 50th year. So it means Yovel, obviously. But Rabbi Herschel Schechter says that he was once heard Rabbi Mordechai Gifter that tells Rosh Hashiva, tell everyone, I sanctified the 50th year when I turned 50. What did it mean? Is that he fulfilled his advance directive when he turned 50. That was what Rabbi Gifter did. And the Tiferes Yisrael actually says this, that this is a mitzvah. Others say, you know, we have the example of Shlomo HaMelech. Before David HaMelech died, we have Sefer Melachim details that David HaMelech kind of gave Shlomo, like, his values. That here's what I want you to know about me. Here's what I want you to do in your life. Here's what I want you to accomplish. He made sure to give over to him a sort of advance directive, a living will. Yaakov Avinu, before he died, he goes through all of his sons, he gives them a sense of like a mission, a purpose, and here's what you should know about me. So there is this idea that one should have, before they die, they should be sharing with their loved ones what their values are. We never know when we're going to die, so the younger the better, we should do this. I did this, you know, already 10 years ago. So it's an important thing to do, and they should be updated. So now let's talk about the document you have in front of you, and let's get specific. Because today you can leave here with a legal advance directive. So I'm telling you how important it is. Like I said, it's really important. We see it in the hospital all the time. In fact, you know what? Let me tell you one quick story. I just thought I should share an anecdote. And I think that will serve to highlight the value of it. So here's a story. This happened here at Cedars-Sinai, but I won't give any other details that you could figure out who it was, though I don't think you would know the person anyways. But they'll maintain their HIPAA, obviously. So here was the story. There was a woman who was at home one day, an elderly woman. She was 94 years old. And she was at home. She lived with her family, with her children and grandchildren. And there was a caregiver. So her kids are at work, her grandchildren are at school. And she's at home one day, and she collapsed at home. Luckily, the caregiver found her. She finds her on the ground. She calls 911. The ambulance arrives, is able to get a pulse back. And as they're taking her, she remembers that she has medical documents stored. Actually, they stored it. Anyone want to guess where it was stored?
In the freezer.
Yes, in the freezer. They kept it in the freezer. That's a thing. It's a thing that some people keep their medical documents in the freezer because it's like, what? And valuable. So it's like, there's just an obvious place where you're not going to lose it. If you put it in files, you're not going to know which file it was. They kept it in their freezer. She runs to the freezer, grabs the file, goes to the hospital with her. In the emergency room, she's stabilized. She's sent up to the ICU. They get to the ICU. After a little bit more testing, the doctor determines she has no brain activity. She's not brain dead, but she has basically no chance of meaningful recovery. So, and he now has the documents that the caregiver provided. The family still does not even know she's at the hospital. It just happened too quickly. They're going to be informed, but it's only been a couple hours since she even collapsed. So the doctor reads her document. She had an advance directive. On the advance directive, it says that she would not want her life prolonged artificially. So the doctor says, okay, if I have no chance of recovery. The doctor says, here, I'm reading it right here. She said herself she doesn't want her life prolonged, so we're going to withdraw interventions and let her die. But he realizes, okay, it did say on there also who her family is and their numbers. So he calls them and says, I'm sorry to inform you that your mother, your grandmother is in the hospital. It's not good. You should come right away. The family gets there. The doctor says, is everyone here yet? Has everyone had a chance to say goodbye? Because we're going to be withdrawing all life-sustaining interventions. And the family, this is a very Orthodox family. The family says, what do you mean? You didn't even ask us our opinion yet. Wait, let us call our rabbi, because I don't think that's what the approach we're going to take. We're not going to withdraw. So the doctor says, oh, well, I'm not asking. I'm telling you. So he said, what do you mean you're telling us? The doctor says, well, it's right here in the advance directive. The son says, let me see that. He says, I never saw this document. He looks through it, and he says, no. This goes against halacha. She was a very religious woman. She went to shul every week. She was very involved with it. She would call her rabbis. She was very religious. She would do what her rabbis say. And I don't think her rabbis are going to say that this is okay. And anyways, we need to call the rabbi and see. The doctor says, well, it's too bad. This is a legally binding document. This is what she wants. We're here to honor her wishes. Not what you think she would want, but what she said she wants. And it says it right here. So the son was furious. And as the family's meeting and discussing, they're like, how could she wrote what goes against halakha? It doesn't make sense. So as the family's looking at the document, they saw it's a long document with a bunch of just initial marks. And they said, it's just like when you download an app on your iPhone and you scroll through everything and you click accept. Do you really go through everything carefully? They said she probably was at her lawyer's office. She prepared all these documents, hundreds of documents. And so she just initialed everything. She clearly didn't read it carefully, because if she did, she wouldn't have said that she wants this. So the doctor found that a little bit more compelling, because the whole family was unanimous. They said, we need to call our rabbi. Then they said, well, which rabbi should we call? Because there was the shul she went to every week. He has one kind of perspective. Then there's the rabbi that used to call her every Friday before Shabbos. A very different rabbi. But maybe she went to one rabbi because he was closer. She couldn't walk so far. We're not sure which is her rabbi. So now the family is left with a whole lot of questions. They're not sure, is the advance directive really binding? Because did she really mean it? If we should call a rabbi, which rabbi should we call? Two of the sons, now the other son arrives, who she didn't live with. The other son says, I think we should have followed the advance directive. But then again, we're not sure. Which child would she have wanted us to follow? It wasn't clear. The advance directive was just a bunch of initials. There was no conversation. The advance directive itself was not a clear advance directive. And so we were left with an advance directive that only made things more confusing. So we realized, okay, we need an advance directive. There is one approach that you could take, which is pretty much the approach of the Aguda and the RCA in the Orthodox community today, which is you have a document where you simply say, who do I want to speak for me and who is my rabbi? And that's the main thing. It says in the document, I'm an observant Jew, so I want Jewish law to be considered. Here's who my family member is, and here's the rabbi, and that's really the main thing, is who the rabbi is to call. And there's a lot of value to that document, because at least it makes it clear what your values are and who to call. And it would have helped us in that situation, right? With that woman, we would have known, okay, who are we asking? And they'll decide for us. Then again, maybe she did have preferences. Maybe she didn't just initial. Maybe she cared. Maybe she saw someone else in her family suffer, for example, and she said, look, I want to follow halakha, but if there's an option, don't prolong suffering. If it's against halakha, obviously I don't want to do it. But if it within halakha, there's choices sometimes. So within halakha, maybe she did have a preference, but we don't really know what her preferences were, unless we can trust what she initialed, which is not totally certain. So others have said, we should have a detailed document where you really detail everything. But there's a lot of problems with a detailed document. One problem, for example, is let's say us, right? I've said we should fill out this document when we're nice and young. But you fill out this document now, hopefully none of us will need it for 50, 60, 70 years, right? We should all be healthy at least that long, right? So 60 years from now, can you imagine what's going to be in hospitals? What kind of medical technology? We can't imagine. So if we would say something that we want now or don't want now, is that really going to be relevant? Even, I was kind of joking about 60, 70 years, but even in 10 years, 20 years, ICU level care is changing so rapidly. Can we really know for sure what we'd want? Also, ourselves are changing. It's one thing if we're young and healthy, or if we have people who are dependent on us, let's say small children or spouse or parents. What if we're in a different stage of our life? Might there be different preferences or goals that we would have? So it's hard to really make a detailed document where you write everything that you would want or wouldn't want when we can't be sure what we would want or wouldn't want, and we don't even know what our illness is. I mean, hopefully we'll all be healthy, but one day when we're in the hospital and we need this help, we don't know if the issue is because, God forbid, we were in an accident or because we're having heart problems, or we don't know what the issue might be. And so that could have ramifications on what interventions we would want or wouldn't want. So these are big challenges with the documents. So what we did at Cedar Sinai was we came up with a new type of advance directive, which is, it's basically two documents. One document is very simple, because another barrier to filling out advance directives was people thought it was too complicated. And so they thought, if it's too complicated, they're not going to do it. So we said, let's make a very simple document where we just list the very basics. Who am I? Who do I want to speak for me? Who are my family or loved ones or friends? And a couple of basic facts about me that you should know about my goals and values and preferences. So you should know basically who I am. It's not listing interventions. I'm not saying if I want artificial nutrition and hydration. I'm not saying if I want DNR or don't want DNR. I'm just sharing basics about myself and what makes me tick, and then hopefully my loved ones and my healthcare providers can apply my values to any specific issues that might come up. And then there's like a wraparound document, which is intended for conversations, like a conversation primer, and forces you to have this conversation, which is the real important thing, because like that woman in my story, she never talked about this with her family. It's hard to have these conversations. People are afraid. If she would have had the conversation, people would have known, but she never did. She went to her lawyer's office one day, initialed a bunch of documents, and now no one in her family even knew about it. But the goal here is that you should actually have a conversation or share it with someone in your family so they know a little bit about who you are, what makes you tick, and that should be helpful in the process. We made this at Cedar Sinai. Then we made a Jewish version of it, where basically, the Jewish version, we just changed a few things. Like, for example, the Cedar Sinai document said, like, funeral preferences. Would I want to be buried in the ground, or would I want a cremation? That was one option. So obviously in the Jewish document, we didn't even give the option for cremation. In the Jewish document, we added also, here's who I want in my family to speak for me. And I would like them to also consult with, not that their opinion overrides, but that they should at least consult with the following rabbi or synagogue. So that and it's a choice. You don't have to put a rabbi or a synagogue, but you could add it. And that let people see like, okay, here's who my rabbi is. And often, hopefully we'll outlive, you know, the time, not our rabbis, but the amount of time our rabbis will be working in the synagogue that we go to, right? They'll be retired, living happily, you know, in Israel. But they'll still be alive, hopefully. But who knows, if you put, you know, any given synagogue, you know, and then 40 years from now is when they actually use the document, this rabbi might not still be the rabbi of that synagogue. But it shows your hashkafa, so to speak, your outlook by which synagogue or which institution. You might put a school or something. It just shows, like, here's what kind of rabbi I want you to consult with. So we put that in the document. And we had a little bit more kind of like Jewish flavor to the document in terms of the questions. That's the Cedar Sinai document. Now, what we have in front of us today, I think is actually improved from that. What we did was, the Cedar Sinai document went through one iteration. Then we got some feedback in which we improved it. Now, there's an organization, and what you have, I'll explain to you why you're very, very lucky today. We didn't tell you when we advertised this, but we probably should have, that this was an exclusive event. Very exclusive. You are the lucky few. That what happened was, there's a new organization. It's not so new. There was an organization called HODES, Halachic Organ Donor Society. And it's changed and morphed, and a new person named Rabbi Shlomo Brody, who lives in Israel, was appointed to take over and just transform the organization, which is not anything you know about the organization. It's just a totally new organization now that has changed and transformed. And one of the things that this new organization, which is called Amitai, which hasn't even been announced yet, the new organization, will be announced in the coming weeks or months. So you're so new that the organization itself doesn't even exist yet. But a new organization is about to be announced, called Amittai, and they are trying to provide resources and support to decision-making and medical ethics and end-of-life issues and all kinds of decision-making when it comes to, and not just end-of-life, throughout healthcare, the healthcare spectrum, and through Jewish values. And one of the first things that they're going to be releasing is an advanced directive. And they love the Cedars-Sinai document, so they worked with me to create their version of it because there are ways it could be improved. And so what they've done is we've taken the Cedars-Sinai document, shown it to lots and lots of different people, including rabbis. This document, the Cedars-Sinai document, we never got it like halakhically approved. This document that you're about to use has been reviewed and approved by Rabbi Mordechai Willig. I'm sure there's many other poskim that will approve of it. That's just who we've taken it to so far. I mean, he is a very important posek in Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University. So he has approved of this document. It's I think simplified from the Cedars-Sinai document, so it's a little bit easier to use and improved, much improved, as you'll see. And it's also legally binding. So just like that one was, so is this. And so what we're going to do now, and so now you're the first group that's being able to use this. It's already legally binding, so you're using a good document. You can fill this out today, as we will do together, have it witnessed by people here in this room, and submit it to your healthcare provider, and it is a legally binding advanced directive. But you're the first group that's gotten to see it. If you do, by the way, have feedback, even little nitpicky things like, oh, that could be worded more clearly, let me know, and I'll share that with them, and they can improve it, because it hasn't been released yet. But it's still, even if we make changes, you still have a legally binding document. This is also already version 3. They finished it, got lots of feedback, got a few rounds of feedback, and this is already like a really the improved version. So this is really great stuff. So let's open it up and start the process. You can either decide that, you know, it's just a worthwhile process to do this anyways, and you can decide, I'm not going to make it legally binding. I'm not going to lock myself into anything here today. I just want to do the process, and then I'm going to just put this away. You know, you don't have to feel locked in. But you could also decide, no, this is important, which it is, and I'm going to go through this process, fill it out, and then actually walk away with an official legal document. So there's a lot of explanation on the first couple of pages. You don't need that now. Most of what I said, I think, I mean, I didn't read it carefully, but that's the gist of it. So turn now to page 4. And we'll walk through it. And if we go too quickly, obviously it's very simple to go back and fill that. But first, just start by filling out your name on the top of page 4. Your name, date of birth, address, telephone number. I think it's worthwhile to include next to your telephone number. It should be your the easiest number to reach you. It could be cell phone or both, you know, home, cell phone, work. You could put your email address there. But what's really important in terms of getting as much detail as possible in terms of how to reach someone is the next line, the next box. And it's really 3 options, which is your proxy, meaning who do you want to speak for you? And I know this can be difficult because you might say, like, I want my children. And I have, let's say, 4 children. How do I choose one? I don't like one of my children better than any of my other children. But it's not about who you like better, but it is important to choose one. You know, it's sort of like my mom, when I told my mom to do this and she did it, and she has 2 children, me and my sister. So when it came to like her financial matters, she appointed my sister. My sister's much better with money, I mean, which is obvious. I became a rabbi, so I'm joking, but but she's just better with money than me. She's good at that kind of stuff. So she said, you know what, when it comes to my like financial durable power of attorney, I'm appointing you, my daughter, to that. When it comes to a healthcare proxy, I'm appointing you, my son. I mean, you work in a hospital. You're more familiar with this stuff. So she said, it's not that I love one of you more. As the alternate, I'm putting both of you as the alternate. But I'm just going to put, like, if a call has to be made, God forbid, one day, and I can't speak for myself, I'm choosing just based on who I think will be better at handling that call. And obviously, if you're not available that day, my other child will be fine at that. But it is valuable to choose one because it avoids a lot of tension. A lot of the reason for this advanced directive in general is to avoid family strife. Unfortunately, at the end of life, a lot of times when someone can't speak for themselves, unfortunately, families start to feud. What would they want? What they wouldn't want? They wouldn't want this, and it could be a lot of tension, a lot of stress. By filling out this document, it's a gift to your family to avoid that stress and just say, look, I love you all. And even to tell them now. That's what my mom told us. Just for when the day comes, so you shouldn't fight with your sister, this is why I chose her for the financial document and you for the medical document. Don't fight. I love you both the same. You know, but there's a value in that. And so you're listing here the number, that person you're putting is your proxy. Oftentimes, obviously, it could be a spouse. It could be a best friend. There are lots of people that you could choose for that. But you just list them first. Then you don't have to put an alternate. But it is a good thing, because it could be that your spouse or whoever it is isn't available at that time. And so it's just good to have, especially like the story I told. When the family shows up at the hospital, we need to know, like, what if the person shows up first, but they're like the second alternate? So we know, okay, wait, we got to wait for the other one. Or what if they're the first one? You could say, okay, we don't have to wait. It's just helpful to know that. So that's what you have, alternate one, alternate two. You could have more. By the way, with any legal document, you can put a note here like, see attached for more alternates or something like that. And you can just write in alternate three, alternate four, alternate five. Right? That's obviously totally legitimate. But it's just beneficial. I know it's hard to choose one, but it's good. So that's what you do there on the bottom of page four is your healthcare proxy and as much detail about how to reach them, because it could be an emergency. And so you need to know their phone number, their work number, their cell phone number, their email address, their Twitter account. I don't know. Like, it's just helpful. If you have it, like, just throw it in there. You never know how it could be beneficial. Then we go to page number five. And still, this is just basics here. If you want a rabbinic consultant. Now, this is different, by the way, just than the Aguda and the RCA documents. The Aguda and the RCA documents, which are great documents, they are much more like the rabbi has the final say. It's really, who's the rabbi? And if the rabbi needs to consult with my family, who should they consult with? This document's a little bit reversed. The primary person is your proxy, but there's also the rabbis to be consulted with. The rabbi doesn't override in this document. The rabbi is just, it's just letting their family know, I do care about Jewish law and Jewish values, and therefore I would like you to consult with this rabbi. And like I said, the alternate there that you have is, we put it also rabbi or institution. I think it's valuable and wise to not just put the names of rabbis, because like I said, you could outlive the time that they are working at that institution. But if you put the institution, that could also be very beneficial. But so anything you know about the rabbi and how to reach them, if you want to. Now, you could have, and when I put a box on the bottom, why there's this box on the bottom is, what we're going to do in just a minute, and really the main focus of this session today, is asking some difficult questions and trying to think about them. You could say, and you can go back and do this later, you might feel like, those questions are very important, I want people to know what I said for them, in which case you would put a check in this box. It could be that you say, you know what, I don't want any details. I only want you to call my family. I don't want to give details. I'm too nervous about that. I don't want it to be misinterpreted. In which case, you're not going to fill it out and you're not going to check this box at the bottom. Page six, we're still now here in the main document about organ donation. This is an important section also. This is talking about posthumous organ donation. Would you want to donate organs after you die? This is very important, by the way, because, and I'm not going to ask for a show of hands here, but some people who choose to donate organs after they die put it on their driver's license. And that's a beautiful thing. You can save up to 8 lives after death. It is a beautiful, wonderful thing. And I know plenty of people who've had their lives saved by posthumous organ donors. The challenge with putting it on your driver's license, as from a Jewish perspective, is that your family has no say once it's on the driver's license. And I've seen cases. I had a case not too long ago where a teenager, unfortunately, was in a horrible accident. He was declared brain dead in the hospital. And when his parents showed up from out of town, they were told, we're going to be retrieving the organs tomorrow. And the family said, whoa, 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 don't you have to ask us first? We're his parents. And they said, no, actually, we don't have to ask you. It's on his driver's license. It's not up to you. And the parents said, well, we don't want it. We don't want to do that. And they said, well, I'm sorry, but we're doing it. So in the end, they were okay with it. They said, okay, they saved 8 lives. And he did save a lot of lives. And they were happy about that. But there's a risk to that by putting it completely in the hands of the government and the hospital. And also, they're declaring death however they want to declare death, meaning by American law. And that could be fine, but halacha also has an opinion about how to define death. And there's differences of opinion. And so what we did here is we wrote it very carefully. She said, once death has been declared by my rabbi. So we're not taking sides. This document does not take sides on when death is declared or which rabbi you have to take, which would have been very controversial, right? Some rabbis accept brain death as a definition of death. Some rabbis don't accept it. So if we would have chosen sides, this document would then become irrelevant for major parts of the Orthodox community. Instead, we just said, whatever your rabbi says. And it could be any denomination, right? Any type of rabbi. But once my rabbi, whoever that is, has determined me to be dead. And also, obviously, this is all now being in accordance with my proxy, my family, the people that I have chosen to speak for me. If they authorize it, then do I want organs donated after I die? So this is a much safer way of donating organs after one dies than on their driver's license. Again, driver's license is a beautiful thing, but it's risky. This is much less risky. Yes?
Question. Just looking at the three choices you got listed there.
Yeah.
Where do you see the choice saying, if my family agrees?
Well, because it's part of this document. I mean, this document is saying that for the first thing on the first page, or page four, was, I want you to consult my proxy. And then my proxy should also ask my rabbi. Now, what do I want them to know about me? So it's still with the consultation of the proxy. They have the primary authority.
You could say over here, yes, I wish it, but they'll consult with the proxy, my wife, and then...
Yeah, and then the decision will be made. Okay. Exactly. It's a good question. It's an important question. Yeah.
So halakhically, is forbidden to donate
organs? Well, no, halakhically, organ donation is allowed. Of course, there's difference of opinion amongst different rabbis. So we are, at the end of the day, saying, check with my rabbi first, right? But organ donation saves lives. The big issues with organ donation are, first of all, determining death. So if a person's not dead by Jewish law, and they were, you know, let's say their heart was removed, that would kill them, right? So that would be forbidden, obviously. But if they are dead according to Jewish law, then it could be allowed. So that's why there was a lot of concern amongst rabbis about organ donation, is because there's some types that aren't allowed. There's other types that are a huge mitzvah. What's not allowed is a type of organ donation that would kill the person to get their organs, if they're alive by Jewish law. Because you could have someone who's alive by Jewish law, but dead by American law. And so by American law, they can remove the organs, whereas by Jewish law, they would be killing them. Depending on how you determine death by Jewish law, it all depends on... So that's why we say, check with the rabbi first. If the rabbi says it, and this is a case where it's allowed, then I'm okay with it. That would mean either the rabbi accepts brain death, or the rabbi says no, only after their heart stops. But even after their heart stops, there's many types of organs that can still be retrieved. So, and then that's allowed, yes. As long as we're careful with those nuances. Yes. So many rabbis will sometimes say, like, no, don't donate organs. It's too risky. But that's because they don't want to get into the nuances. But once you are, if you want to do it and you're willing to get into the nuances, you say, okay, no, check with the rabbi. Let's consult. Then you could do it in a way that's halakhically permissible. There could be some organs. So if someone does not accept brain death as being death...
Is there eight organs?
Yeah. So there wouldn't be eight. If someone does not accept brain death, let's say, many Orthodox rabbis don't accept brain death as the halakhic determination of death. If you don't accept brain death, there's not really any way to get a heart out, because the heart would be beating still. And so you probably can't donate a heart if you don't accept brain death.
The heart stops beating, you can't
use it. Usually not. Unless there could be a way of doing it, then, which there might be eventually, especially. But... otherwise, no. Right. And there's also DCD. There's a type of organ donation that does not rely on brain death, but it relies on withdrawing interventions to hasten death. And that would likely not be permissible under Jewish law, but that's also protected by this form because it's going in accordance with the rabbinic guidance. So, yes?
Is there an age limitation for donation?
Well, there is. It depends on which organ. So oftentimes they'll say like age 75 is the limit, but sometimes they can check with certain individuals and say, like, oh, actually, this person's, you know, liver is very good or whatever it might be. And also there are sometimes tissues like skin or bones that they might want to be able to use, and those might be able be usable much later. So if you feel like you're not comfortable with it, this form gives you the option to just simply say, second box, I do not wish to donate any of my organs or tissues. You can simply put that and you can say, that's fine. You could say, no, if I can, and it's allowed by Jewish law, and it's a huge mitzvah, I want to. So then what you would be putting, this is the first box, I authorize my proxy to approve transplantation of any organs or tissues permissible under Jewish law and custom. So you're making sure that it's only if the rabbi says yes. Or you could say, you know, I'm okay with some things, but not others. And if you have your own personal opinions about that. So then you'd put the third box, and then you could actually just write in and put what you would want. So that's the organ donation option. Yes?
Is there a list of rabbis that are known to be one way or the other that you could select?
That's a good question. I mean, you could discuss it with your rabbi. Yeah, that's a good question. Like, for example, those who accept brain death, you have like the chief rabbinate of Israel. and certain other rabbis. Those who don't accept brain death, a lot of prominent, especially, it tends to be oftentimes in like the religious Zionist community, modern Orthodox community, many more accept brain death, whereas in the more Haredi community, it's much less common to accept brain death. I don't want to say that as a rule because you have idiosyncrasies. You know, there's always some outliers. So you could have some in the Haredi world that do accept it, some in the modern Orthodox world that don't accept, but that often tends to be the dividing line.
Isn't the list? Would it be a good idea to establish a list?
Well, for example, I wrote a book on this topic called Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making. So in my book, in the footnotes, I did list. So for example, you have a list there, for example. It should be updated every few years because that list is already 5 years old, but yeah. And you can ask your rabbi where they side on that. So that's one issue. Next issue. And again, this is for you to decide. Yes?
First it goes to the person that you're choosing to make the decision. If they decide that's it, end of life, that's it. The rabbi, you don't have to consult. They don't have to consult the rabbi.
They don't have to.
The person says, we're done. Brain dead. You know, I know for a fact this person does not want to be, you know, connected to tubes once they're brain dead. So that's the end of it. The rabbi then can't jump in and say...
The rabbi can't override it. It's just a matter of integrity in terms of the proxy to say, like, they want me to check with the rabbi, so I should probably call the rabbi. But the rabbi cannot step in and override it. They can definitely call you and say, like, look, they asked you to call me, so shouldn't you be calling me? Like, we need to talk about this. But they can't, like, block it. Yeah. Right. Hopefully these minimize, you know, conflict by having this. So the next issue, the next section. Yes. Say more.
In that point that, like you said, you have different family members involved, and so once you start listing people and differences of opinions, then you're going to yield yourself up. I mean, this isn't really locking any one particular...
Well, it is locking. You're saying who my number one proxy, who's my decision maker. They're the official durable power of attorney. They have the final say. Of course, everyone wants to avoid conflict and fighting. Well, that's your responsibility to update the document. Seriously, in the Israeli dying patient law, they suggest there that everyone should update their advance directive every 5 years. There is something to be said for that.
Yeah. You need to put a clause that says, regardless of what my proxy says, I want this to happen. Like, I want you to ask this rabbi if you don't know anything.
You could say that, of course. You could not have any proxy. You could only have the rabbi. Or you could have only one proxy. You could even put, and I've seen people do this, by the way, you could even put who not to call. I know it sounds funny, but I've seen people put in their advance directives, like, for example, at the end of my life, don't let so-and-so into the hospital. And there's sometimes value to that, because if it would be upsetting to you, hopefully we don't have these situations, but sometimes it's at least valuable that we should know. Because you get a lot of fighting when people can't speak for themselves. Oh, we've had so many crazy situations. We've had people show up in the hospital and take pictures at the bedside with, like, selfies with the person to try to claim that they should be included in the will. Because, yeah. Look how close we are. We're friends. See, I have a picture of us together. Like, wait, that's not a normal picture of a person on a respirator with you taking a selfie with them. But somehow people think that that's somehow legally binding. But anyways, the more detail you can put in the document, it could help for all these issues. Even better could be if you think to yourself, I don't want this person there, but maybe I should try to make up with them before the time comes so that I don't come to that. That would be even better, right? And we've seen this too. A lot of times hospitals lead to healing in families because people realize, you know what, if not now, when? That was what the Chofetz Chaim said. By the way, the Chofetz Chaim said, why should you have an advance directive? The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Im ein ani li mi li. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? And if not now, when? By the way, Amitai, that's part of where you get this name of this organization from. If not now, when? So a lot of this whole idea of having this document was, if I don't speak for myself, who will speak for me? And if not now, when? So these are important points. And there's going to be more. It's going to get much more detailed. So after I die, there's these two boxes. The point of these is that we would think that most observant Jews are going to want these two things that we're about to read right now, but you don't have to. Meaning this document is allowing everyone to make decisions for themselves. It's not forcing you, it's kind of encouraging. So box number one here, and then in the middle of the page. All decisions concerning the handling and disposing of my body in preparation for burial, including removal of tubes, catheters, IV lines, cardiac devices, and cleaning of the body, are to be made pursuant to Jewish law and custom as authorized by my proxy. Meaning, you know, we have Jewish customs that when someone dies, we leave any lines that are connected to blood. And the Chevra Kedisha, when they do the Tahara, they have ways. If any of you have done a Tahara, you've seen this. They have ways of removing the lines that keep the blood in the body. And if not, then they bury the line with the person. Because we're supposed to be buried with blood that we die with. If there's any blood at the time of our death, we're supposed to be buried with it. In fact, sometimes if there's cloths that are like put on someone to like absorb blood, we'll bury those with them. Oftentimes I've seen in the hospital, we'll take the sheets, if there's blood on the sheets, and we'll give it to the Chevra Kedisha. So assuming that someone would want that, they just check this box. I don't see why someone would not want that, but theoretically they could. And then the final one here is that unless there's a specified authorization by my proxy in consultation with my rabbi, it is my desire and hereby direct that no post-mortem procedure be performed on my body, meaning autopsies. Unless sometimes there's no choice, right? Sometimes it's really, really necessary medically or legally, but this is saying otherwise I don't want an autopsy. It's something that's pretty much standard for an observant Jew, but we're giving you the choice at least to check that, yes, I don't want an autopsy unless it's otherwise necessary.
So you check both these things?
Yeah, you would check both of these if you want.
It's not a choice of the two of them.
One right, it's not either or. Yeah, it's just check, yes, I want this, check. Exactly, yes.
Why is it okay to remove organs from the body and not okay to have an autopsy?
So they're very different. The organs that's being removed to save a life, meaning it is important to point out, because sometimes organ retrieval happens not to save a life. I mean, sometimes it happens either for medical research or even for cosmetic surgeries for people. This is very popular in California, and I'm not joking, actually. They'll remove body parts for cosmetic surgery, for plastic surgery, you know. Someone could say that that's valuable, but it's different. But when an organ is removed, if someone's kidney, pancreas, liver, lungs are removed to save a life, that's different than an autopsy that's done. Sometimes an autopsy is done to save a life, right? If someone got an illness and the doctors are afraid, you know what? This might be happening to other people. And if we can do an autopsy now, we could find out what's going on and we could save other lives that are in our hospital right now. Then it's allowed. Like their children, especially. It could be some kind of an inheritable disease. But let's say they're doing an autopsy because, you know, this is great. This could be a great body to do, you know, some classes on, and we could, you know, it's always interesting to bring groups of students in to have bodies, cadavers to do some practicing on. One could make an argument that, oh, that's saving a life too, but that's a difficult argument. It's much more removed, not quite obvious how it's saving a life, especially if it's just kind of for practice. You could make an argument like a surgeon made a mistake and they want to see where they went wrong and that could help them in future cases.
Let's say to determine whether the person choked or was strangled. They choked on food.
Yeah, so for legal purposes.
Yeah.
So sometimes those are justifiable, halakhically even. It depends on the case, though. So sometimes there's other ways of doing it, for example. Sometimes we can do it much more minimally invasive just by taking a biopsy and getting some fluids. Sometimes we can do it through imaging. And actually, the LA Jewish community bought imaging machines for the LA County Coroner, which exists now downtown, that they can sometimes, instead of doing an autopsy, they can do very sophisticated imaging and look inside the body without cutting it open. And that's much more respectful to the body. We prefer that to an autopsy. But when it comes to organ donation, we believe that that's actually a merit for the person. And also it stays alive, that part of their body staying alive. We do ask them to then return everything else to the body and treat it with dignity and speedily and then bury the rest.
Is there a condition like limited autopsy?
Yes, there is. We often ask for that limited autopsy. Yep.
It's not on this form?
It's not on the form because the form just simply says, ask my rabbi. The rabbis all know about this. The rabbis know how to advocate for their congregants when it comes to autopsies. We do it all the time.
Are Reform rabbis different than Orthodox rabbis on these issues?
Could be, yeah. Could be a difference there. But if you're very concerned about that, you could write it in. Always these documents, you can write things in if there's something you're concerned about. And there's going to be a space. You're going to see at the end, we put spaces. Do I have any specific concerns or things that I just want to make sure people know about me? Write it in. And that's a great example of something to write in. Either way, you could say, you know, I believe I want my body to be used for medical research. If my rabbi approves, I want my rabbi to know that I'm in favor of that. So please decide once the time comes. Something like that could come up.
I don't want my rabbi to give me any surprises, you know.
Right, right. Well, you should talk to your rabbi about these things too, by the way. All this stuff should be talked about. We encourage you to give a copy to your rabbi and to say, like, here are some things I want you to know about me. I get calls from rabbis all the time saying, you know, I got a call from your hospital that so-and-so's in the hospital. They asked me about this and that question. I don't want to tell them, but I don't remember. I don't know who this person is. Do you have any impression of who they are and what they would want? And you can't blame. Rabbis meet a lot of people. If it's someone who's not a regular in their synagogue, then how can you expect them to really know details about them? So one thing they could say, oh, I remember that person used to come on, you know, this holiday or whatever, but to actually know details about who they are and what their values are.
So do you keep like a roster, for example? Would you keep a listing of the people who select you to be their rabbi in these determinations?
I have a file, yeah. Yes.
But that's not. But you can always know,
probably. Yeah, I can't always know every detail.
No, I mean, not necessarily everybody notifies you that you're the...
That's true. That's true. Rabbis sometimes get calls and someone like, oh, wow, I didn't know that I was there. I haven't seen them in 30 years. But that does happen. That's why the more detail, the better, because the rabbi's going to have to decide. And they'll follow Jewish law, but oftentimes Jewish law has options. There is room for, it depends on who that person is, what they would want. So there might not be 15 options, but there might be 3 options within Jewish law. And, you know, so it still matters. Let's go on a little more. So now what you would do is you simply sign it here. This is what shows I filled out this document. This was me, everything until now. So you would write your name, you would sign it, the date, and your address. This makes it almost legally binding. And then you turn the page. And we're not going to take the time to do it now, but you can either quickly do it with someone sitting next to you or just when we finish today. And then on page 7 is what makes it officially legally binding. It's in either or. You either have 2 witnesses sign it, and you could literally have anyone in this room, you know, just hey, you were here today, just sign it and put your name. It does not require, the person who's signing it is not binding themselves to anything, right? All they're saying is, yes, I saw that you are the person that you say, you know, me, John Doe, I signed it. Yes, I see that John Doe signed it. Perfect. I'm signing that I saw it. No one can call me and say, why did you tell me to pull the plug? You know, so just, I didn't say anything. All I said was I saw them sign their own document. They decided for themselves, right? So you would witness for each other and 2 witnesses. In California, in most places, to make a document legally binding, it's either 2 witnesses or a notary. You don't have to have a notary. You can have 2 witnesses or a notary. I don't think we have an official notary here this morning. So you would but we do have more than 2 people here. So you can just have 2 people sign it, and then it's done. It's binding. And you're done. You have your document. You now have made it clear who your proxy is, who your rabbi is or institution, and a couple of things about, you know, organ donation, if you'd want it, you don't want it, and that's it. And you could be done. And you could rip off the last pages of this and just say, okay, now I have a legally binding document, which is pretty good because it shows my religion, it shows my basic values, and it shows my proxies. But what we think is even better is if you keep going. Just a few more pages. And, yes? It could be. There's differences in different states. So, in California, it's very, very, it could be almost anyone. One thing that it can't be in California is employees of the hospital. So, for example, I can't actually. If you're treated at Cedars-Sinai, I can't be one of your witnesses. But, because there could be conflict of interest. But, yeah, it could be anyone. Man, woman. I think it should be an adult. I'm pretty sure it has to be an adult. But, yeah. No, because they're witnessing now. If they died before they witnessed, that would be a problem. But if they died before the document was being used, that's fine. It became legal right now, and it's good. If another document is ever filled out in the future, including a post by one's doctor, whatever's later date becomes legally binding. So, but it's binding as of today, and it stays binding.
How about a former employee?
Then it's okay. So you're good. You could sign it. Yes. Right. So California has some of the most, you know, simple, legal, liberal, I don't know the right word for it, but in terms of who can do it. If you're concerned that like, oh, I might end up in another state, first of all, this is binding in other states, so don't worry. But if you want to just like be extra careful, like let's say not have a family member sign it, something like that, you might take that approach. But
the form says you're related by blood is an exclusion.
Right, because of some states. So maybe don't have a family member sign it because that's more broadly legally binding in more states. So, yeah. So that's probably better. But it's pretty flexible in California.
Do you need to fill one out if you live in Israel? Do you happen to know? Like, wouldn't it be like
No, it's not necessarily going to be correct just because it's in Israel. In Israel, there's also forms, advanced directive forms. And they, see, even these forms, just by the way, even though I'm not 100% sure if they'll be legally binding in Israel, I think it would be. But with all these documents, even if they're not legally binding, there is still value. Meaning, even if it's just like a napkin, and someone comes, because in the hospital, when we have to make decisions on behalf of someone who can't speak for themselves, we look for any evidence we can find, any evidence of their value. So if someone comes in and says, oh, look, I have an advance directive that they filled out at a workshop one Sunday morning. They didn't get it witnessed. It wasn't notarized. But other than that, I have this document. We will use that. Okay, if it comes to court, if there's a fight over it and it goes to court, it's not going to be valid. But usually it doesn't go to court. Usually we just want to know. And if we have, if you find it, you're like, oh, wow, they gave me some details. So, oh, great. So that could be used. If it's, even if it's not legally binding. It only needs to be legally binding if it goes to court, which it usually doesn't. You know, if there's a fight, if there's a feud, obviously it helps have it legally binding. But so anyways, just another point about it. Like, there's value either way. Okay, so now what we're doing, this last section, is you filled out a document that gave some basic color to who you are. But what if we want to know a little bit more about what makes you tick? And what we're going to be asking now are not halakha questions. They're values, goals, values, and preferences. So we're turning to page 9, and this is just an opportunity for you to describe a little bit about who you are. The ideal here is to do this in the context of a conversation with your family. If not now, like, if you're going to do this now, which is good because you're just here right now, you might as well do it, to then share it with them. It shouldn't be that they just find it one day and all of a sudden say, oh, this is interesting, I didn't know these things about my loved one. So it's encouraging, that's what we call it, a conversation primer. It's encouraging you to actually have this conversation. There's a great thing, you can look it up online, the Conversation Project, which is a really wonderful tool. And it's a beautiful thing, a beautiful way to connect with family and really have meaningful conversations. It's a great thing. So anyways, here are some questions. Again, the questions I'm about to ask you, you can fill it out as we go. And I'm just going to ask you the question, and you just fill out what you think. If you're not sure, you can leave it blank also. You don't have to, you can leave things blank. And the goal here is, again, just to describe who you are. This is not making the halakhic decisions here. Not making any decisions. No decision will be made for you on the basis of what you write. Only it will help people know about who you are. So you'll see, and it gets more and more specific as we go. So first we want to know a little bit about your pain and risk tolerance. Are you someone who can endure pain and is willing to endure risk, or are you someone who does not want to? Right? So it helps to know that. So for example, the first question, top of page 9. I value undergoing potentially painful treatments if they have the potential of prolonging my life, even if they will not cure my underlying illness and may lead to significant discomfort, right? I am willing to undergo painful treatments to have my life prolonged, even if not cured. So if you say, if you agree with that, yes, I am willing to undergo it. So you'd click on high there, right? All the way on the right. If you say, no, I don't want to undergo painful treatments just to prolong a life, that's not a cure. So you could put low. If you're not really sure, you could put it in the middle or somewhere in between. But it could be helpful to know that about you. What's your pain endurance like when it's not for the sake of cure? Sorry?
Tolerance.
Pain tolerance. Yeah, that's really the right way to say it. Yes. And then the next question. Next question is, I value undergoing potentially painful treatments to try to prolong my life toward the goal of participating in a specific occasion, like a family wedding, bar bat mitzvah, or birth, even if they will not cure my underlying illness. In other words, the first question was saying, I would want my life prolonged, even if it can't be a cure, no matter what. Just prolong my life, even if it's painful. If you agree with that, it was high. If you don't agree with it, you'd put low. Now the question is a little different, though. My illness can't be cured, but I do want to endure pain to make it to a certain event, if there was such an event, right? Obviously, we can't predict. So if you put high for the first one, you're probably going to put high for the second one too, right? If you're going to say, I would want to endure pain just to stay alive, you'd probably want to endure pain to make it to a wedding, right? But if you put low for the first one, I don't want to endure pain to stay alive, you might think here, well, wait a second. If there was an upcoming bar bat mitzvah or something, then would I want to endure pain to make it to that? So you might put a different answer there. You might not, and you might not be sure. You can leave it blank. But it does help to, again, these are important things to think about. Yeah.
Some categories for which treatments you're willing to endure.
We're going to get there. We're actually going to get there. To which to list more specifically which treatments. Yes, very good.
On this form?
Yes, on this form. The goal of this form is to be as simple and brief as possible, but also to be as inclusive and, you know, include as many issues. So it's hard, but yes, we're going to have a place for you to start listing which interventions. You might not know that either, but some people might know. So, yes. Yeah, but that's the goal here is to that we care. It's trying to figure out what's your opinion about that.
I know, but say a person puts median.
Yeah.
So who defines median?
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of gray area here, and like I said from the beginning, this is one of the examples of advanced directives are never perfect, but it does give you some color. If someone puts very high, I'm willing. That tells you something. And they put median, they say, okay, somewhere in the middle. And probably we'll make the decision based on what we do oftentimes, which is like, what would the average person want? You know, what's reasonable? But it just helps to know. It could be that the ethics committee will help, but they're not going to decide for you, but they might. If you put medium, so it's showing you that it's average. If you put median for everything in this whole form, it's going to be less valuable than if you have stronger opinions about things. This form is more beneficial to someone who has strong opinions about something. If you sort of feel like, okay, whatever the average is, so then you just put the average, you just put in the medium. And
the high isn't like electrocution.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, it's still within reason. It's still within reason, but it shows, because it could come. I had a case last week, where we had a patient who was undergoing what would be considered significant, you know, interventions and lots of pain, and the family was arguing that the patient would be willing to endure, and the doctors were arguing that no one would be willing to endure this. And it was just an argument between the family and the doctors. The family did win in the end. I mean, we really had to push hard, but that's not always what's going to happen. And if you had a document like this and it showed that, that would really be helpful, because then we say, okay, now they've spoken for themselves. Before, in this case we had last week, it was just a debate based on what we think, and that's much harder. Okay, let's go a little further now. Third question. And now it's becoming yes or no, a little bit easier because it's based on the nature of the question. It is my medical team's responsibility to try to balance pain relief with maintaining my alertness, right? Sometimes pain relief means knocking someone out, but we want to be awake, right? So the question is, when it is difficult to maintain both, I would prefer them to. What would you rather? Be awake, or even if it means some pain, or no, just treat the pain. I don't care if that means I'm not going to be alert. You might not have an opinion about this, but
I just don't know.
I'm sorry?
I just don't know.
You might not know, so you might leave it blank. But someone could say, you know what, I want to be alert. I don't value just being on machines unconscious. Someone else might say, no, I don't want to be in so much pain. If they can treat the pain, treat the pain. So that's up to you. At that time, you won't be able to express an opinion because you'll probably be in so much pain, right? I know it's talking about alertness, so you would think so, but oftentimes people could be alert but not really still able to participate in decision-making. Or it could be we need to get them to that point where they can then if you're really alert, you might be able to say, like, you know what, this is too painful. So then you'll have the right to do that. But you might not have an opinion, but some people do.
Has anybody ever produced a video that shows the various conditions that we're choosing?
Actually, so first of all, with this group, Amitai, we've made some videos that will be released soon. And by the way, there's a great intellectual, the person is named Thaddeus Pope, who does a lot of work about advanced directives. He's a great bioethicist. And he just wrote an article recently arguing that people should make video advanced directives in addition to their legal ones, because sometimes you can tell more by the voice inflection and the kind of the way they describe it can give you more detail, and that could be a great way. So I know you're not asking about that. You're asking about specific interventions and to look at them on camera, which we're actually making some videos like that. But yeah, we've made 3 so far.
Well, how long do we have to wait then? Because I'd like to see that video before I make these choices.
This should be released pretty soon.
Soon in weeks or soon in months?
I think weeks.
Yeah. How will we know?
Be in touch with me. Send me an email. I'll put you on a list that I have, and I'll try to send out a mass email.
Or can you just take the people who are on this list? Like, who would not want to know?
Do you have an email list of people
yes.
here? So.
Yes.
Fine, I can send out an update. I can send out an update to the people who attend here because I have your email address, and I'll give you some updates, especially if we update this document and we have that available. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, good point.
Are you selling it or just...
No, it's free, totally free. This all is free. This organization is not doing anything for money. It's a nonprofit. Yeah. Yeah.
They should make that video available at the hospital.
Well, we might. We made it at the hospital, obviously, because we showed the interventions.
With actors or with patients who were enduring the levels of...
Well, it was me and Rabbi Brody and a couple of nurses, some of whom could be actors, some of whom were not learned from that they don't want to become actors.
No,
but
how do we know if it's really painful? Yeah.
Well... Yeah, I mean, it's subjective. That's true. But there are ways that doctors can tell, by the way, that by looking at, you know, your heart rate and your blood pressure, they can have some idea if you're in pain, if you're suffering or not. So, okay, next one. I value undergoing high-risk procedures if it could. So again, I value undergoing high-risk procedures if it could cure my illness. So are you the type that would be willing to engage in a risky procedure so that it's not like a certain thing, but it could be curative? And we just want to hear a yes or no. If you're not sure, you could, because again, these are human documents, you could put a middle there. You could put like maybe, right? Or somewhat, or slightly, or you know, you could write it differently, but we just want to know, and you might not have an opinion. Again, these are all things that some people have strong opinions, some people have no opinion about. But would you want to do high risk, but it could be high benefit also? Okay? Next. In general, do you value undergoing high-risk procedures if it could possibly stabilize my condition but not cure it? So this is a risk, not for a cure, but for stabilization. Are you the type that would want to endure risk just for being stabilized?
Does that mean we don't want it to be cured?
Meaning this is a case where it can't be cured. It's that it can't be cured. Of course you want it to be cured. Right.
What would be an example of that?
Someone could have... let's say someone has a horrible cancer, God forbid, that's really spread. But in some places, it's causing the most pain and suffering to them. There could be a surgery, let's say, that could remove much of the cancer. It's not going to cure it because it's too spread, but it will relieve a lot of the pain. However, the place where that cancer is, it's a risky surgery. Let's say that's an example. They could do this risky surgery to relieve a lot of pain, but it's not going to cure it. Right, no. This is about the risk. You're willing to endure risk for that. Okay, next one. Next question. I value undergoing high-risk procedures if it could possibly extend my life by any amount of time, like a few days or weeks, but not cure my illness. I would want high risk for any prolongation of life. Are you the type that says, if I could get another 5 days, risk it. Go for it. Are you the type that would say, you know, if it can't be cured, I don't want to risk. That's up to you. And a lot of these, you can imagine, by the way, these are examples of the types of things that rabbis, they're not always clear halacha. Like halacha might say, if someone's life is dependent on a respirator, do not withdraw. Do not pull the plug, as they say, so to speak. Do not terminally extubate if they will die immediately as a result. That might be, you don't have a choice. The rabbi's going to say it's not allowed. But in these cases where it's like the doctor says, well, there's a risky procedure, we could try it. A lot of these cases are where rabbis would say, well, it does depend on if the person's willing to endure it or not. That there's choices in halacha. It's not all, we usually say in halacha, you know, we have less autonomy than like in American values, but there is still autonomy. There's such thing as autonomy still in halacha. There are times when it matters what you would want. And the rabbi's going to say that's what matters.
Once again, you're filling out the document giving your proxy
yeah.
last decision.
Yes, the proxy is going to decide because the proxy knows you. And the proxy is going to look at this and just say like, okay, this helps me decide. But it's not that the doctor or anyone's going to look at this and say, oh, because they wrote no here, we're not doing it. It's only to help the proxy and maybe the rabbi along with the proxy to know what's what I would have said.
And the proxy could still completely disregard.
Yes, because the proxy could say, you know, it doesn't really apply in this case.
Or my values are different than their values.
Well, the proxy's job is to represent the patient's values.
No, the proxy's job is to execute the advance directive.
Which is to sue.
The advance directive gives the proxy...
Yeah, but so in American law and in Jewish law, there's something called substituted judgment and best interest standard. Best interest standard means I can decide what's in your best interest. Substituted judgment means I have to decide what you would say if you were here right now. And by American law and Jewish law, substituted judgment is what we favor. There are times, like for example with children or someone who oftentimes they have this homeless people, for example, where we don't even know their name. So then we apply best interest. We just say, well, what would be in their best interest? Because I don't know who they are.
Okay, so
but otherwise, the job of the proxy is to do what the person would want, not what the proxy wants for them.
So with this document, could the proxy decide completely against what the person's wishes are, and then the hospital or the rabbi go to court and say, hey, that's not what the person wanted because they have to check.
I suppose you could imagine a case. Let's use the organ donation. Let's say the person says, I want to donate my organs. And the proxy says, I didn't know that. I'm against it. And someone else comes forward and says, like, it's not fair. This person said they wanted to do it, and their rabbi has approved it in this case, so they should be allowed to. You could see them overriding the proxy. You could imagine a case where the document is clear enough, and the proxy was going against the document clear enough that they could be overridden. You could imagine such a case. Because the goal is to the patient's values. Yeah. And then you have here, and we put this a few times throughout, comments. The goal of the comments is, any questions that you've had in your mind while we've been talking about this, is now you can write. So we put a lot of yes or no's, but they might not fully encapsulate what you think. So you might now you could write here, I want to make it clear that this is only if, you know, whatever you're thinking to yourself right now, or if there's things, you might have not filled out any of these boxes. You might have thought, you know, none of these boxes really describe my values. I'm going to leave them all blank. But now in the comments, you might say a line or two about, but you know, I do want you to know that please try, for example, even if it's risky, maybe I'm willing to do some risk. Or you might say, like, if it's very, very risky and the doctor's not certain about it, you know, please think twice or something like that. That doesn't, like, bind you, but you might want to write something, like, about your value. Or in or you might tell a story of a great way of doing this, by the way. And by the way, the way we convinced the hospital last week in the case I told you about, when they were saying to us, like, it's so much pain, how do you know she'd want to endure it? The way we finally convinced them was the patient's husband, a year ago, had a similar illness, and she was the decider, right? She was the proxy, and she decided to try to fight for, you know, to fight for him, even though it was painful, because she felt like that was what we value based on Jewish law and her values. So we were able to say to the hospital, look, when it was her decision for her husband, she did it, so she would probably do it for herself as well. And they said, oh, that's actually a pretty good point. If she showed that that's what she... So you might want to write in here sometimes, and hopefully your proxy will know, like, let's say, the way Uncle Bill, I don't know, I'm just making up a name. The way Uncle Bill died, I would not want that, or something like that. Or what Uncle Bill did, that was too much, or so, you know, something along those lines, which might help also for your proxy. And that's oftentimes a very helpful way of including information, you know, stories of family members, and if you liked what happened or didn't like what happened in their situation. Okay. Next, it's just a couple more, but they get pretty specific. Just this last page and a half here. So this now, you might think that how is this relevant? But I'll explain to you. It's very relevant. These questions might seem lower stakes than the last questions, but they come up a lot. As a patient, now this is top of page 10. As a patient, I generally prefer knowing three choices: as little as possible about my condition and treatment, only a general summary of information about my condition and treatment, or all of the details about my condition and treatment. People often, you might think to yourself, why would I ever not want to know? But first of all, there is such a thing in Jewish law. In fact, I was once asked to be an expert witness in a court case because there was a case in another state where a patient went to surgery for a totally different issue. And while she was in surgery, unfortunately, the doctors found horribly spread cancer throughout her body, and they realized that she was terminal. She had only weeks to live. And the family was informed before the patient woke up from the surgery. And they said, do not tell her. And the doctor said, of course we're going to tell her. They said, do not, it's against our religion. And they said, what do you mean it's against your religion? I said, yeah, it's against our religion. If you tell her, this is not cultural sensitivity. And they said, and we'll sue you. And they even put a note on the door that said to anyone coming in, patient is not aware of the condition, do not say a word. And you do find ancient Jewish texts that do talk about protecting a person's emotional well-being and not telling them all the details. On the other hand, it's important sometimes to know because you have to make decisions. And someone might want to know. You know, they might feel that they can handle it, or if they have to make a decision, or they might think it's worse. Sometimes if you don't tell someone, they imagine the worst, and they think that things are even worse than they thought. So it could be important. So you might have your own opinion about that, and it's important to know. So you might be someone who says, you know what, I don't want to know the details. If it's my family is deciding for me, like, don't tell me all the details. Or you might say you want to know the details, and this actually comes up a lot. So you might not have an opinion. Again, you could leave it blank, but this could be very, very helpful.
It comes up a lot when a patient is conscious or sedated.
Well, they're usually sedated when the determination happens, but then they become conscious.
Oh.
And once they're conscious, you know, they might not be at the point where they have full decision-making capacity, but, you know, it could still be helpful to know. So that's helpful. Next question. If I have a terminal illness, I prefer Very similar here. Not knowing how quickly it is progressing, only having a very general sense of my prognosis, knowing the best detailed estimation for how long I have to live. Do you want to know the details, or do you not want to know too many details? Would you find it scary? I know Rabbi Levi Meir of Blessed Memory has in his book, one of his books, I forgot which one now, but he told a story at Cedar Sinai that there was once a psychiatrist at the hospital who, he told two stories in that. He told one story that he was once walking a patient to surgery, and while they were walking to the surgery, a physician walked by and said to him, "Oh, you're going for the surgery now?" He said, "Yeah," and he said, "Oh boy, this is a big one. It's a big risk what they're doing. I hope you make it out alive." And he said, "I was shocked." The person went from being totally confident to he started crying, and we almost had to cancel the surgery because he didn't want to go into the surgery. So I couldn't believe someone would talk to him like that. But sometimes people aren't careful. He tells another story in there that he was with a patient after they got some test results, and the doctor said to him, "We got some results. You know, we'll do some more testing, and we'll see how things go." And the patient said to him, "Doctor, I know you know more than that." And he said, "No, it's okay. We're going to figure it out over the coming days." And the patient said, "I'm a psychiatrist. I can handle it. Tell me all the details." The doctor says, "Are you sure?" He says, "I'm sure. I'm telling you." And he says, "I wouldn't normally tell people, but it's bad. It's really bad. And you don't have long to live." And Rabbi Meir says that person went into horrible depression, and within 2 days he died. And Rabbi Meir argues it was maybe because it was told to him in such a stark, horrible way. So anyways, and like I said, other people feel like, no, but we need to know details. There's things you can do. There's things you can do about it. And I'll otherwise assume the worst. So these are just these questions that are helping us to know about you. How much would you want to know? How much detail? Next one. If I'm deemed terminally ill, I would prefer. So this is someone, God forbid, is terminally ill. Either treatments focused only on comfort and managing my symptoms. In other words, pain management, because they're terminally ill. No, or they would want treatments focused on comfort and managing symptoms while also being open to potentially painful treatments or procedures that might extend my life. In other words, they're terminally ill, but they are willing to endure painful treatments to extend their life, or treatments focused on extending my life without prioritizing my comfort. Their main goal is to live as long as possible, not comfort. Do you have an opinion here? This is similar to some on the last page, but... They're very hard. What? By comfort is meant only comfort medication, whether that's morphine or fentanyl or whatever that might be. Just comfort medications to make sure that I'm not experiencing pain, but not curative. But, or would you, because there is no cure, so, but would you, in this person's case, or would they want, if they could be have their life kept, being kept alive, even if it's not cure, even though that means pain, would they want that?
Yeah.
These are all within the parameters of halacha. You can imagine there being such a case that someone makes a choice that violates halacha, but the strict interpretation of these are all basically within halacha. A person could choose. Like halacha allows, if someone, God forbid, is dying, and the doctor says, "We could just give you, you know, pain medications to make sure you don't suffer," there, or we cannot give pain medications, but we could give another medication that might help you to live a little bit longer. So halacha might say in these cases, like, if it's a choice between living for 2 weeks and 4 weeks, you could choose. If it's a choice between living 2 weeks and 10 years, halacha might say, no, you have to try to, you know, live the 10 years. But when it's just such a minimal difference, it's your right to choose which you'd rather endure. Within halacha, even. Yeah. Okay, final question in this section. And then again, there's comments if you want to add something. But if I have, God forbid, an irreversible lack of cognition, right? Unalert. As in a case of advanced dementia or severe brain injury, right? So a person who now is confused or just not able to think clearly. I would prefer, and this is common, treatments focus only on comfort and managing my symptoms. Treatments focus on comfort and managing my symptoms while also being open to potentially painful treatments or procedures that might extend my life, right? Similar to the previous question. Or treatments focus on extending my life without prioritizing comfort. So this is different than the previous one because the previous question was about a terminal patient. This is about a patient who has not able to think clearly, where they just want to be comfortable, or would they want to have their life prolonged despite some pain and confusion that might be associated with that?
Does that mean feeding? I mean, we talk about things like feeding tubes and stuff.
Or it could be. I mean, there could, usually halacha is going to have an opinion about artificial nutrition hydration, which we're going to discuss, and that's going to be left to the rabbi. But there could be some times when that's relevant. In fact, I think we're going to... Yeah, we don't have it here. So, you know, it's a good point to maybe add in for the comments if you have an opinion about nutrition, artificial nutrition and hydration there as well. Oftentimes, it's going to depend on what the rabbi says, but there could be room for it. Or those could be the treatments itself. It could be, do I want an invasive artificial nutrition to keep me alive despite the pain that I want, which I don't have now, but which will prolong my life, or would I rather just not endure starting that? That could be the treatment itself, is nutrition.
Does dementia play a part in the decision?
It sometimes does, yes.
If it's severe.
If it's end-stage dementia, yeah. It could. Depends who you ask. This is kind of controversial because it's not considered terminal necessarily per se, but it could be part of a dying process, and that could be relevant for the rabbi in the decision-making process. Yeah, definitely.
What are some of these painful treatments that I just mentioned here in the abstract?
It could be a surgery. It could be, let's say, a trach. You know, if someone wants to have a tube, surgically inserted into their throat, or simply not start with that. You know, there could be kind of long-term, kind of permanent interventions that are painful, but could keep someone alive longer. Yeah. Well, living with that might be more painful than living without it, but it might be worth it. Someone could live without a trach, let's say with that example, for 2 weeks, and then they're gradually, not able to breathe. But if someone has the trach and they could live for, 2 months, that might be worth it, but it's definitely less comfortable to have it than to not have it at all.
On the pain scale, would that be low or high?
Well, it's probably low.
The trach is low.
But, yeah. The endotracheal tube, the intubation that goes to the throat is worse, actually. You know, that's much harder, more difficult to bear.
And they're usually sedate.
Usually, not always, but it could be awake, yeah. Okay, last section. And much, kol hakavod, much credit to all of you for enduring this conversation, because it's not an easy conversation to have, but so important. Most people are not willing to have these conversations. Okay, physical and social independence. This could be really valuable for decision-making. Remember, a lot of decisions have to be made for someone who can't decide for themselves. All kinds of decisions, including like where they would live and how they would live. And that's important to think about. So we want to know about you. So how much do I worry about needing someone to help me with basic daily activities? In other words, is that something that I would never want someone to have to help me with my basic activities? Or you say, no, I mean, especially if it's my family member who loves me and I cared for them, like I'm not worried about that, or somewhat. Feeling that I'm an excessive burden on others. Do I really worry? I do not want to be a burden on others. Is that something that you have a strong value about? It might just be, somewhat, but it could be I extremely really don't want to be a burden. Or you might feel like, no, it's not, I mean, this is what family does for each other. I'm not worried about that. I'd rather not be a burden, but it's not a strong, high worry of mine, so you could put not at all. And being alone and feeling lonely. It's just important to know. Is that something that you really worry about? I think most people would not want to be lonely, but do you have a strong fear of being lonely? Then again, you could have some people who are like very independent and like being lonely. I don't know.
Question.
Yeah. It could come up with in terms of like deciding to put someone into a home versus keeping them in your own home, hiring a caregiver versus having family members taking care of them. You can imagine in these types of cases, like if someone's feeling really guilty to know this about their loved one, like it could help them to make those decisions. And in fact, this is where you really get more specific in these last questions here. Being cared for in the home of a family member. Do I strongly disagree that I'm worried about that? Or do I strongly agree Do I strongly agree that I worry about being cared for in the home of a family member, right? So, or do I strongly disagree that I don't worry about that? In other words, I would want to. And in fact, if you want to make it clear, you can even write it in the words. You can even write which family member. If you'd say, no, I would want to be in my, niece Jill's house, but not in my nephew Joe. I don't know. I'm just making up names. Not Joe, but Bob. being cared for in a nursing facility or long-term care facility. Do I worry about that? In other words, strongly agree I would not want to be in a nursing facility or long-term care facility, or I'm not so worried about that. In other words, I would put strongly disagree or somewhere in the middle.
Strongly disagree means you don't want it?
Strongly disagree means I'm not worried about it. So I do want it. I'm okay with it. Strongly disagree means I'm okay with it. Strongly agree means I'm worried about it.
Yeah,
I said it wrong. I misread the thing. I'm sorry. I was looking at the top. If I became difficult, and look at this next, at the box, the beige box. If it became difficult for me to live in my home, I would value. I said it wrong. Yeah, thank you. I would value, so being cared for in the home of a family member, I would value that, strongly agree. I would value being cared for in the home of a family member. Or, no, disagree. I don't need to be in the home of a family member. And then being cared for in the nursing home or long-term care facility, strongly agree that I would value being cared for in a nursing facility. Or no, strongly disagree, I would not value being in a nursing home or care facility. That it's helpful for your family to know that about you. Remaining in my own home, even if it meant limitations in the amount of skilled medicine, medical care I could receive, do I strongly disagree that I would value remaining in my own home? Or do I strongly agree? No, I would really, really value staying in my own home. And that's also could be helpful to know. Or do you have other comments here that are important for you to know? These could be family specific. Like, oh, in my, I'd want to be in a home if it was, you know, so-and-so's home. They have a comfortable home. Or no, not in this home, because then I'd have to live in, you know, Alaska or something. I don't want to live there. I don't know. I'm just making stuff up. But every family is different. You could have such a thing where you know, you want to put specifics there. And that's the end. That's really the end. The last page is where we put in a few of you, you know, are there, and this is where we put in the paragraph there, are there specific interventions, specific machines that you would want or wouldn't want? Is there, if, and we put here like, you might want to finish the sentence. It meant a lot that my mother or so-and-so died in their home, you know, how another person died. Or you may want to finish the sentence. What matters to me at the end of life is, are there any kind of end-of-life considerations? There's just things that are important to you that now you just have room to write and just share. You don't have to, but is there anything specific? I would never want to be on a respirator, but I would want to have artificial nutrition. Or I wouldn't mind being on a respirator, but I wouldn't want to be in an ICU. I'd rather be in a facility. Or I don't know, any thoughts you have.
What if a person says, I want my dog to be with me?
Yeah, no, that's good. Stuff like that comes up. I would want
a nursing home.
Right, or that could, some nursing homes might allow it, some might not. I would want my wedding picture on the wall if I was there at the ICU. I don't know, like, I would want a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe under my pillow or something. I don't know, like, types of things people sometimes request. If you have something, if you think about that, if I was got admitted in the hospital and I couldn't make a decision for myself and my family deciding for me, I want you to know, and this is where sometimes people write who they would want to be at their bedside when they die or who they would not want there. These types of things, if you might not have an opinion about it, but if you have thought about it, that's where you write it. Yes. To be allowed but not required.
Yeah.
Oh, unless it's a, you know, indefinitely.
Yeah, so that was kind of my question. Like, I don't want to endure anything.
Okay.
I don't, you know, I'm fine. Super coward, whatever. And my proxy will know that. But then if the doctors come and say, oh, she needs this procedure, it's going to be very painful, but that can be for another 5 years.
Uh-huh.
So what's the decision to be made?
Usually in Jewish law, so we have a concept of chayei shah in halacha. Chayei shah means terminal. If someone's terminal, we have this concept of chayei shah lo chayei shinan, that we're allowed to allow someone to die who's already terminal. And we're allowed to have, like, let's say, a risky procedure that just like prolongs the chayei shah, prolongs the terminal life, but doesn't extend it. They're not, but it's not required. But the rabbis say if someone could go from chayei shah, from terminal, to chayei olam, which is not terminal, they're expected to do that, to endure pain, to go from a likelihood of living, let's say, 2 months to more than a year. But there is a question of, like, how much pain and how much risk. So if it was certain, let's say the question was zero pain and zero risk, then it would be certain that it would be required. Let's say it's like a blood transfusion, right? All you need, we already have the IV in even. All we need is to transfuse the blood and the person will live fine. We don't do it, they die. So there's no risk and it's almost certain that it will save their life. So the rabbis say, you have to do that. But let's say once the risk is higher and the pain is higher, the rabbis might encourage it but not require it. So you might still even have room there. If you have strong feelings about that, you would say, I don't want pain or risk, no matter what. So that might still be relevant depending on what the situation is.
But halacha is going to prevail, obviously.
Halacha could prevail, but halacha could even justify your decision if it's very high risk and very high pain. They could still say, okay, you know what, even though it could give her 5 years, we might not force her to do it if she doesn't want to because it's such high risk and such high pain. Yeah.
You just mentioned something about a year.
Yeah.
Survival is what determines whether someone's terminal or not.
Yeah.
Is that typically the...
Some say 6 months is actually the number we go with. Yeah.
That's why you need to
Yeah, exactly. There's so many differences of opinion. It depends that your Rav can help guide those decisions.
There should be a specialization, really, among Ravs. Is
it, well, you know, yeah. There are some rabbis that specialize in that.
I mean, that would be like on a list with health grades, so you see how...
Yeah, but it's important to have your rabbi that knows you and that represents your values and your halachic values. And the rabbis should know who to consult with that will help guide them. And they'll still make the final decision, but with expert consultation. I can tell you that I get calls from rabbis all the time. Just walk me through how this looks in the hospital. My congregant has this issue, and I'm going to decide for them, but let me. I just want to check in with someone who works in a hospital and like talk it through, and then I'll decide. And that's a responsible thing that rabbis do. So.
Sounds like it could be a full-time job for someone. You
know, yeah. It is. Right. Yes, good point. Okay, and then the last question you have here is simply, the first one was meant to be kind of like decision-making, end of life, and this last question is, is there anything about your own funeral? And this can be extremely helpful, by the way, for family members. You might not, it might be a morbid thing to think about, but unfortunately, it's going to happen to all of us, and it could be really, really special, you know? It might either be, please read such and such poem or psalm, or make sure so-and-so speaks at the funeral, or please read, you know, you could have something that you once wrote some at some time. Please make sure someone reads my such-and-such at the funeral, or like I said, sometimes I have seen this, people put like, please make sure so-and-so doesn't speak at the funeral, or please make sure that it's at such-and-such place. You might not have bought your plot yet, everyone should, as I said before, but still, you might just write here, you know what, please make sure it's in Israel, or please make sure it's at such-and-such cemetery, you know, like, I didn't get around to buying it yet. I know it's irresponsible, but here's where I want to be. And so you could put it there, and that is helpful too. So if there's anything like that, write it in there. And all of this, what you would do is you could submit this entire document, ideally. For sure, the proxy and the rabbi should have the entire thing. You could just rip off the front, the first, I think it was 6 pages or whatever it was. Yeah, the first 6 pages, no, 7 pages until the witnesses, and submit that part to your doctor. Make sure that's in your, you know, you're signed to be your CS link, or, you know, make sure that's on file so that they know how to reach it. You could just submit that part, but then make sure that the proxy and the rabbi has the whole thing with the conversation primer at the end, so that they, when they're called by the hospital, says, oh, you know what, you are listed as the proxy for so-and-so. We have a question for you. Then they can go in their files or their freezer or whatever and pull this out and say, oh, yeah, we did talk about this. They mentioned it, that they would want to endure risk or they wouldn't want to endure risk. So at least the proxy and the rabbi should have the whole document. Yes?
So the proxy should be the witness?
Sorry?
Witness.
Yeah, once it's witnessed and legally binding, that's when it should be given to the hospital. And ideally it should be shared. If you want your values to be followed, you should make sure as many people have it. So you should have your doctor has it, you know, your hospital has it, because you can upload it to your, you know, all hospitals have now, like at Cedar Sinai, we have like MyCS link. You can upload it to your chart. Then you make sure that all your proxies have it, your rabbi has it. Like, just make sure they all have it. And that way, when the time comes, someone will be able to find it, because you want someone to find it, because if you care about what it says here, yeah. Right?
Question. I know in the lower right-hand corner, it says www.ema.org.
Yeah, that's the organization that made this document.
If you want to get additional copies of this, you can use your copy.
Yeah, they're not. It hasn't been released yet, so if you go there now, you're not going to find it.
So this is the only thing you can get.
Yeah, you can email me. I have, and we can get it to you. But yeah, as of right now, like I said, you are exclusive bunch. This is a very exclusive. No, there's no other way to get it right now. Not even on the line. Sure, I have before in the past, actually. But, yeah, it's a very important topic.
So, at the office in UCLA, before I was having a surgery, they said I could bring in my healthcare directive.
Right.
And they could put in a national database that anyone could access.
Yes. I'm somewhat familiar. I mean, I've heard of it, but I don't know exactly how to do it. But, yes, right, there's a national database for advanced directives. I think so, actually. And if I'm not mistaken, I remember they've been talking about a lot of different initiatives that they want to do in this regard, but yeah, that's a great idea. But yeah, but if someone could take the initiative and upload it there, that's amazing. I'm not sure if they, with the national database, I'm not sure if they do that or not. I'm just not 100% sure, so I can't say.
Especially because it would be good for the EMTs, the first responders.
Exactly. Right. You never know. You could be a Cedar Sinai patient, but you could be either be in another state or another neighborhood or end up somewhere else. Right. You know what a lot of people do also, I don't think they have this yet, but I think they're planning on it, and you could do this yourself, is people will have a wallet card. And in their wallet card, it will say, because oftentimes in the emergency room, for example, social workers, part of their job is to go through people's wallets and see if it says anything. And they'll put in there, I have an advance directive, and here's where you can find it. Here's who you should call. It's like a little summary advance directive. Make sure to call so-and-so for my advance directive.
There should be a way that you could add it to your own personal, like Apple wallet or whatever. But
yes, right.
Even more important than sharing with a national database, and sometimes even harder, is sharing it with the people who are closest to you that may actually be with you.
Yes, exactly.
You don't have to rummage through files to find it.
Yeah, by the way, I mean, that's a great idea. Like, in addition to giving it to people who are close to you, like, let's say you were to email it to them also. Because in the heat of the moment, you can oftentimes search through your phone and, like, find an old email. You might not remember where you filed it, but it's just, if you want this to be followed, you should have it in as many places as possible. So to email it to your loved ones, file it, give it to your rabbi, give it, you know, as many ways of finding it as possible, ensure that it will be followed to the greatest extent possible. Yeah?
I have a question about, you mentioned that this should be recognized. In talking with another lawyer, he pointed out that sometimes the hospital will not recognize it's not homemade. In other words, this is Bellary at Cedar Sinai. Will St. John's accept it?
They should. I mean, I've seen at Cedar Sinai, we've gotten, let's say, St. John's advance directives, and they're legally binding documents. They accept it. It doesn't mean, it's not like you have to have done it at our hospital. Okay. Yeah. So it should be. I mean, there's sometimes idiosyncrasies, whether it's like a VA hospital or some certain countries or states that might have very specific rules. But hopefully it'll be accepted. And if not, at the very least, it will still help in decision making, as long as it doesn't end up in court. Yeah.
If you want to amend it,
Yeah, so amending it, you can either add a new one, just do a totally new one, and then they'll follow whatever the latest date is. Or you add amendments, and then you just initial and date. I'm not sure. It's a good question.
It's always a good idea. Whenever you amend something, do it all over again.
Just do it all over again is the safest way.
Oh, this page from this document, this page from this document.
Right.
A recipe for disaster.
Right.
Yeah, definitely when it's a second.
Yeah.
So are you aware of something in Israel that...
Israel has. I know that they have. I just don't know well enough to tell you what it's called and what to use. But I'm pretty sure, I mean, most of these documents can be used there. But yes, there's a whole system in Israel as well. They have their own advanced directive system.
So if you're traveling there a lot, you probably want to figure out what that is.
Probably a good idea to use the Israeli one if you're going to be there a lot. Yeah. Yes?
Hi, so my name is Greenberg, and I'm going to be continuing this workshop the last Sunday of every month.